that Rogers had strenuously denied. When she next arrived at 26 Broadway, he demanded, "Where did you get that stuff?" That tense, brief meeting ended their relationship. While stewing about Rogers, Rockefeller would have been equally shocked and wounded had he seen the acidulous comments made to Ida Tarbell by his old pal Henry M. Flagler, who portrayed the Titan as petty and miserly. After their confidential talk, Tarbell recorded in her notes, "Mr. Flagler talked to me of J.D.R., says he is the biggest little man and the littlest big man he ever knew, that he would give $100,000 one minute to charity and turn around and haggle over the price of a ton of coal. Says emphatically, I have been in business with him for 45 years and he would do me out of a dollar today, that is, if he could do it honestly." Though Flagler dispensed some pious claptrap about how the Lord had prospered him, Tarbell could not draw him into any serious, sustained discussion of Standard Oil history. From the start, sensing that Tarbell was full of malice toward Standard Oil, Archbold had refused to cooperate. As for Rockefeller, he was slow to fathom the magnitude of the gathering threat, and had no notion that this magnificent journalist could wield her slingshot with such deadly accuracy. Having weathered 30 years of assaults in the courts and state houses, he must have felt invulnerable. When associates clamored for a response to Tarbell, Rockefeller replied, "Gentlemen, we must not be entangled in controversies. If she is right, we will not gain anything by answering, and if she is wrong, time will vindicate us." To sit through an extended grilling from Tarbell would have violated his lifelong approach to business. This was a tactical blunder, for in dodging Tarbell, he inadvertently seemed to validate her portrait. From the perspective of nearly a century later, Ida Tarbell's series remains the most impressive thing ever written about Standard Oil. A tour de force of reportage that dissects the Trust's machinations with withering clarity. She laid down a clear chronology, provided a trenchant account of how the Combine had evolved, and made the convoluted history of the oil industry comprehensible. In the dispassionate manner associated with McClure's, she sliced open America's most secretive business and showed all the hidden gears and wheels turning inside it. Yet, however chaste and clearly reasoned her prose, it was always informed by indignation that throbbed just below the surface. It remains one of the great case studies of what a single journalist, armed with the facts, can do against seemingly invincible powers. Tarbell is perhaps best appreciated in comparison with her predecessor, Henry Demarest Lloyd, who was sloppy with his facts, florid in his prose, and too quick to pontificate. A meticulous researcher, Tarbell wrote in a taut, spare language that conveyed a sense of precision and restraint, though she had more than her quota of strident moments. By writing in such a relatively cool style, she made her readers boil with anger. Instead of invoking political panaceas or sweeping ideological prescriptions, she appealed to the reader's sense of common decency and fair play, and was most effective where she showed something small and mean-spirited about the Standard Oil style of business. Like Teddy Roosevelt, Tarbell did not condemn Standard Oil for its size, but only for its abuses, and did not argue for the automatic dismantling of all trusts. She pleaded only for the preservation of free competition in the marketplace. While she was by no means even-handed, she was quick to acknowledge the genuine achievements of Rockefeller and his cohorts, and even devoted one chapter to the legitimate greatness of the Standard Oil Company. There was not a lazy bone in the organization, not an incompetent hand, nor a stupid head, she wrote. It was the very fact that they could have succeeded without resorting to unethical acts that so exasperated her. As she said, "They had never played fair, and that ruined their greatness for me." If Tarbell gave an oversimplified account of Standard Oil's rise, her indictment was perhaps the more forceful for it. In the Trust's collusion with the railroads, the intricate system of rebates and drawbacks, she found her smoking gun, the irrefutable proof that Rockefeller's empire was built by devious means. She was at pains to refute Rockefeller's defense that everybody did it. "Everybody did not do it," she protested indignantly. In the nature of the offense, everybody could not do it. The strong wrested from the railroads the privilege of preying upon the weak, and the railroads never dared give the privilege save under the promise of secrecy. To the contention that rebates were still legal, Tarbell countered with the questionable theory that they violated the common law. She argued that Rockefeller had succeeded by imbuing subordinates with a ferocious desire to win at all costs, even if that meant trampling upon others. Mr. Rockefeller has systematically played with loaded dice, and it is doubtful if there has ever been a time since 1872 when he has run a race with a competitor and started fair. Tarbell rightly surmised that Standard Oil received secret kickbacks from the railroads on a more elaborate scale than its rivals did. This is abundantly borne out by Rockefeller's private papers, which show that the practice was even more pervasive than Tarbell realized. Beginning with the Cleveland Massacre of 1872, Tarbell showed that Rockefeller had taken over rival refineries in an orchestrated atmosphere of intimidation. She exposed the deceit of an organization that operated through a maze of secret subsidiaries in which the Standard Oil connection was kept secret from all but the highest-ranking employees. She sketched out many abuses of power by the Standard Oil pipelines, which used their monopoly position to keep refractory producers in line while favoring Standard's own refineries. And she chronicled the terror tactics by which the Trust's marketing subsidiaries got retailers to stock their product exclusively. Like Lloyd, she also decried the Trust's threat to democracy and the subornation of state legislators, although she never guessed the depths of corruption revealed by Rockefeller's papers. Nevertheless, as Alan Nevins and other defenders of Rockefeller pointed out, Tarbell committed numerous errors, and her work must be cited with caution. To begin with, the SIC was initiated by the railroads, not Rockefeller, who doubted the plan's efficacy. And for all its notoriety, the SIC did not cause the oil crisis of the early 1870s, but was itself a response to the glut that forced almost everybody to operate at a loss. It is also true that, swayed by childhood memories, Tarbell ennobled the Oil Creek drillers, portraying them as exemplars of a superior morality. As she wrote, they believed in independent effort, every man for himself and fair play for all. They wanted competition, loved open fight. To support this statement, she had to overlook the baldly anti-competitive agreements proposed by the producers themselves. Far from being free marketeers, they repeatedly tried to form their own cartel to restrict output and boost prices. And, as Rockefeller pointed out, they happily took rebates whenever they could. The world of the early oil industry was not, as Tarbell implied, a morality play of the evil Standard Oil versus the brave, noble independents of western Pennsylvania, but a harsh, dog-eat-dog world. Though billed as a history of Standard Oil, the Tarbell series presented Rockefeller as the protagonist and center of attention. Tarbell made Standard Oil and Rockefeller interchangeable, even when covering the period after Rockefeller retired. Sometimes it is hard to tell whether Rockefeller is a real person or a personification of the Trust. Significantly, Tarbell chose for her epigraph the famous line from Emerson's essay on self-reliance. An institution is the lengthened shadow of one man. When Henry Rogers questioned this approach, Tarbell noted the dramatic effect of focusing on one individual, writing in her notes after the meeting, illustrated by Napoleon work and the effort to keep the attention centered on Napoleon, never mentioning anybody if I could help it. This great man approach to history gave a human face to the gigantic amorphous entity known as Standard Oil, but also turned the full force of public fury on Rockefeller. It did not acknowledge the bureaucratic reality of Standard Oil, with its labyrinthine committee system, and stigmatized Rockefeller to the exclusion of his associates. So Flagler came off relatively unscathed, even though he had negotiated the secret freight contracts that bulked so large in the McClure's exposé. However path-breaking in its time and richly deserving of its accolades, the Tarbell series does not finally stand up as an enduring piece of history. The more closely one examines it, the more it seems a superior screed masquerading as sober history. In the end, Tarbell could not conquer her nostalgia for the Titusville of her girlhood, that lost paradise of heroic friends and neighbors who went forth doughtily to do battle with the all-devouring Standard Oil Dragon. The most celebrated and widely quoted charge that Tarbell made against Rockefeller was the least deserved, that he had robbed Mrs. Fred M. Backus, forever known to history as the Widow Backus, blind when buying her Cleveland lubricating plant in 1878. If every melodrama needs a poor, lorn widow, cheated by a scheming cad, then Mrs. Backus perfectly fitted Tarbell's portrait of Rockefeller. If it were true, Rockefeller later conceded, it would represent a shocking instance of cruelty in crushing a defenseless woman. It is probable that its wide circulation and its acceptance as true by those who know nothing of the facts has awakened more hostility against the Standard Oil Company and against me personally than any charge which has been made. The background of the story is simple. In his early Cleveland days, Rockefeller had befriended Fred M. Backus, who worked as a bookkeeper in his office and taught in the Sunday school of their church. In time, Backus married, had three children, and started a small lubricating company. In 1874, the 40-year-old Backus died, likely from consumption, and his widow inherited an obsolete plant that consisted of little more than a primitive cluster of sheds, stills, and tanks. Its hilltop site meant that raw materials had to be hauled up the slope at great expense, and then the lubricating oils had to be carted down the same steep path, not the most efficient of venues. Before it entered the lubricating business, Standard Oil had tolerated this marginal operation. When it branched out into lubricating oils and greases in the late 1870s, it absorbed three small lubricating companies, of which Backus Oil was probably the most backward. In fact, the Backus operation was so outmoded that Standard Oil eventually shut it down. This did not prevent the widow Backus from stirring up a rabid national controversy about Rockefeller's supposed theft of her priceless plant. When Standard Oil first approached her about the purchase, she insisted upon dealing with Rockefeller, who, for old time's sake, agreed to meet her in her house. Appealing to her status as a widow and trusting to his gentlemanly honor, she pleaded for a fair price for her property. As she recalled, "He promised, with tears in his eyes, that he would stand by me in this transaction and that I should not be wronged. I thought that his feelings were such on the subject that I could trust him and that he would deal honorably by me." Backus told a friend that Rockefeller suggested that they kneel together in prayer. Up until this point, her story tallied closely with Rockefeller's, who said that he had been moved by kindly consideration to an old employee. While Backus wanted Rockefeller to conduct the negotiations for her plant, he knew nothing about lubricants and sent his associates instead. According to Backus, Rockefeller's hirelings bilked her unmercifully. She valued her operation between $150,000 and $200,000. Whereas the Standard Oil people refused to pay more than $79,000, $19,000 for the oil on hand, plus $60,000 for the factory and goodwill. Out of regard for Backus, Rockefeller had had his appraisers bump up this last figure by $10,000. Backus's negotiator, Charles H. Marr, later swore that his client, in an estimated inventory of her assets, had written down $71,000 for plant and goodwill. Not much more than Rockefeller finally paid. Yet she grew incensed over the purchase price and drafted a savage letter to Rockefeller, accusing him of double-dealing, to which he made the following reply. "In regard to the reference that you make as to my permitting the business of the Backus Oil Company to be taken from you, I say that in this, as in all else that you have written, you do me most grievous wrong. It was of but little moment to the interests represented by me whether the business of the Backus Oil Company was purchased or not. I believe that it was for your interest to make the sale, and I am entirely candid in this statement, and beg to call your attention to the time some 2 years ago when you consulted Mr. Flagler and myself as to selling out your interests to Mr. Rose, at which time you were desirous of selling at considerably less price and upon time than you have now received in cash, and which sale you would have been glad to have closed if you could have obtained satisfactory security for the deferred payments." He then pointed out that the $60,000 paid for the property was two or three times the cost of constructing equal or better facilities, a statement corroborated by Mr. Maloney, superintendent of the Bacchus plant. I believe that if you would reconsider what you have written in your letter, you must admit having done me a great injustice, and I am satisfied to await upon your innate sense of right for such admission. In closing, Rockefeller offered to restore her business in return for the money or give her stock in the company at the same price paid by Standard Oil. It was an eminently fair offer, and yet the histrionic Bacchus flung the letter in the fire. Because Ida Tarbell insisted upon reviving this hoary story, Henry Demarest Lloyd had already wrung tears from readers with it, in 1905 Rockefeller's attorneys leaked to the press a letter written by H.M. Bacchus, the widow's brother-in-law. Having lived with his sister-in-law during the period in question, he was present the day Rockefeller paid his visit. As he told Rockefeller, I know of the $10,000 that was added to the purchase price of the property at your request, and I know that you paid three times the value of the property, and I know that all that ever saved our company from ruin was the sale of its property to you, and I simply want to ease my mind by doing justice to you by saying so. It was exceedingly lucky for Bacchus that she bowed out of business, for Standard Oil built more modern lubricating plants, marketed 150 different lubricants, and drove prices far below the price at which she could have operated profitably. Had she stayed in business, she would have been bankrupt within a few years. By investing her proceeds in Cleveland real estate instead, Bacchus, far from being reduced to filth and misery, became an extremely rich woman. According to Alan Nevins, she was worth approximately $300,000 at her death. Nevertheless, the supposed theft of Bacchus Oil became an idée fixe, and she dredged up the story for anyone who cared to listen. The notion of Rockefeller gleefully ruining a poor widow was such a good story, with so fine a Dickensian ring, that gullible reporters gave it fresh circulation for many years. If Tarbell perpetuated one myth about Rockefeller, she also had the honesty to debunk another, that Rockefeller had blown up a competing refinery in Buffalo. It was this allegation that so upset Henry Rogers that he cooperated with Tarbell to clear his name. Swallowed whole by Lloyd and constantly brandished by the world, the tale was a hardy perennial of the anti-Standard Oil literature. Like the Bacchus case, the incident dated back to the period when Standard Oil entered the lubricating business in the late 1870s. The trust had coveted the vacuum oil works in Rochester, New York, owned by a father and son team, Hiram and Charles Everest. One day, John Archbold shepherded Hiram Everest into Rockefeller's office and asked him point blank to name a price for his firm. When Everest obliged, Archbold threw back his head and roared with laughter, dismissing the figure as absurd. Taking a suaver approach, Rockefeller leaned forward, touched Everest on the knee, and said, Mr. Everest, don't you think you would be making a mistake to go into a fight with young, active men who mean to develop the entire petroleum industry? When Everest shot back that he was a fighter, Rockefeller just smiled. Everest eventually realized he was dealing with an immovable force and sold a 3/4 interest in his firm to Henry Rogers, John Archbold, and Ambrose McGregor, acting as agents for Standard Oil. Because the Everests remained the managers, the Standard executives were involved only tangentially. In 1881, a trio of vacuum employees, J. Scott Wilson, Charles B. Matthews, and Albert Miller, defected to start a rival refinery, the Buffalo Lubricating Oil Company. They brazenly planned to recreate their old firm by transferring technology, poaching clients, and copying processes patented by vacuum. When the Everests learned of this, they threatened legal action. Albert Miller repented and sought help from Hiram Everest. Together, they consulted a Rochester lawyer, and at this meeting, Everest allegedly floated the idea of Miller sabotaging the new plant. Suppose he should arrange the machinery so it would bust up or smash up. What would the consequences be? A tall edifice of speculation would be erected on this query. According to a later conspiracy charge, on June 15, 1881, Miller ordered the firemen at the Buffalo plant to heat the still to such explosive temperatures that the heavy crude oil began to stir and boil. Pretty soon the brickwork cracked, the safety valve blew off, and a large volume of gas hissed out, without kindling a fire. A week later, Miller met in New York with Hiram Everest and Henry Rogers, who packed him off to work at a California cannery. When the Everests filed patent infringement suits against the Buffalo refinery, Charles Matthews, ringleader of the Renegades, retaliated with his own civil suit, charging a conspiracy to blow up his Buffalo works and seeking $250,000 in damages. The three Standard Oil worthies on the vacuum board, Rogers, Archbold, and McGregor, despite the distant nature of their involvement in Rochester, were indicted along with the Everests. Only vaguely aware of the brouhaha, never having met Miller, Rockefeller was roped into the case for publicity purposes and subpoenaed as a prosecution witness. The case always struck him as a petty irritant, distracting him from more pressing matters. Nothing in Rockefeller's papers suggests that he regarded the suit as anything other than outright extortion. In May 1887, Rockefeller sat captive in a packed Buffalo courtroom for 8 days. Resentful of being turned into a public spectacle, he felt he was being served up as a sideshow freak to this curious class of wonder worshippers, the class whom P.T. Barnum capitalized on and made his fortune out of. When Rockefeller testified, he displayed, as always, total forgetfulness, but in this instance he really knew little about the case. At the end of 8 days, the judge dropped charges against Rogers, Archbold, and McGregor. While Rogers hugged a bunch of pansies given by a well-wisher, Rockefeller, in a rare display of public fury, rose from his seat, jaw clenched, and said, "I have no congratulations to offer you, Rogers. What should be done with people who bring an action against men in this way? What?" Wheeling about, he shook his fist at Charles Matthews. Then, muttering, "What an unheard-of thing," he strode briskly from the courtroom, his retinue in tow. In later years, he fulminated against Matthews as a scheming, troublemaking blackmailer who offered to sell his refinery to Standard Oil for $100,000 and only initiated his nuisance suit after being rebuffed. The Buffalo suit, in truth, had scant merit. The prosecution never established that an explosion had taken place or even that a high flame was necessarily hazardous when starting up the still. Though the Everests were convicted and fined $250 apiece, this small figure mirrored the jurors' belief that the Everests did not conspire to blow up the refinery and were guilty only of luring away Albert Miller. If Henry Rogers cooperated with Ida Tarbell for the sake of vindication in the Buffalo case, he was amply rewarded. She stated categorically, "As a matter of fact, no refinery was burned in Buffalo, nor was it ever proved that Mr. Rogers knew anything of the attempts the Everests made to destroy Matthews's business." Yet the notion that Rockefeller enjoyed blowing up rival plants so tickled the popular fancy that it remained enshrined as a story much too good to retire, and it was duly revived, along with the musty canard about the Widow Bacchus, by Matthew Josephson, in his 1934 book, The Robber Barons. By the third installment in January 1903, President Roosevelt himself was voraciously reading Tarbell's articles and even sent her a flattering note. Her celebrity spread with each issue, and her level gaze stared out from countless newspaper profiles. "The way you are generally esteemed and reverenced pleases me tremendously," McClure told her. "You are today the most generally famous woman in America." That she had succeeded in a traditionally masculine field only added to her mystique. Samuel McClure would let a series run as long as the public kept snatching up copies. As Tarbell summarized this policy, "No response, no more chapters. A healthy response, as many chapters as the material justified." Hence her series was open-ended and profited from the tremendous crescendo of attention which drew more and more Rockefeller critics from the woodwork. The circulation of McClure's had risen to 375,000 by the time Tarbell's series was finished. Though the series was published as a two-volume book in November 1904, she then capped it with a scathing two-part character study of Rockefeller in McClure's in July and August of 1905. It does not detract from her achievement to state that she enjoyed the services of a first-rate research assistant, John M. Siddall. Short, pudgy, and bespectacled, the young Siddall was an experienced hand, having been a cub reporter at the Cleveland Plain Dealer and secretary to the Cleveland Board of Education during Mayor Tom Johnson's reform administration. Based in Cleveland, he not only supplied Tarbell with numberless facts, but charged her imagination. "I tell you, this John D. Rockefeller is the strangest, most silent, most mysterious, and most interesting figure in America," he wrote to her. "The people of this country know nothing about him. A brilliant character study of him would make a tremendous trump card for McClure's." At first, Siddall thought Rockefeller cold and humorless, but had to modify the caricature. "My informant states that John has a real delightful way of cultivating the speaking acquaintance of all sorts of people, rich and poor, black and white. That only illustrates again the marvelous complexity of Rockefeller's character." One of the first and most shocking revelations dug up by Tarbell and Siddall came from a teenage boy who had been assigned to burn records at a Standard Oil plant each month. He was about to incinerate some forms one night when he noticed the name of a former Sunday school teacher who was an independent refiner and Standard Oil rival. Leafing through the documents sent for burning, he realized that they were secret records obtained from the railroads documenting the shipments of rival refiners. Tarbell knew Standard Oil was ruthless, but she was shocked by this outright criminal activity. There was a littleness about it that seemed utterly contemptible compared to the immense genius and ability that had gone into the organization, she said. At this point, she realized she was being snookered by Henry Rogers. Tarbell and Siddall were willing to take their own moral shortcuts to expose Rockefeller. To spy on him, Siddall had a friend from the Plain Dealer impersonate a Sunday school teacher to sneak into the annual church picnic at Forest Hill. At Siddall's behest, an old Rockefeller friend, Hiram Brown, pumped the mogul on several matters, including his reaction to the McClure's series. At the mention of Tarbell's name, Rockefeller steadied himself with a long breath. "I tell you, Hiram, things have changed since you and I were boys. The world is full of socialists and anarchists. Whenever a man succeeds remarkably in any particular line of business, they jump on him and cry him down." To secure photos, Siddall had a friend pose as an agent of some distant Rockefeller relatives to obtain snapshots of the magnate from Cleveland photo studios. "Now, of course, these pictures were got under false pretenses," Siddall reminded Tarbell, "and we must protect our overzealous friend." Since Rockefeller banned Tarbell from his presence, Siddall searched for a way that she could obtain a first-hand glimpse. During summers at Forest Hill, Rockefeller appeared in public only for Sunday services at the Euclid Avenue Baptist Church. By the early 1900s, this event had taken on the air of a circus spectacle as hundreds of people massed outside the church to view him. As the Tarbell series swelled the gaping throngs, Rockefeller would gingerly approach his church bodyguard before the service and ask, "Are there any of our friends, the reporters, here?" Even though Pinkerton detectives mingled with the crowd, Rockefeller now felt anxious about public exposure. Sometimes, he confessed, he wanted to bolt from the service, but he feared that people would brand him a coward. At one Friday evening prayer service, when a radical agitator sat opposite him all evening, his hand stuffed menacingly in his pocket, Rockefeller grew so rattled that he put away his planned speech on socialism. It probably hurt his image that he appeared in public only at church, for it played to the stereotype of a hypocrite cloaking himself in sanctity. In fact, his motivation for church-going was quite simple. Aside from the spiritual pleasure of prayer, he was loath to give up contact with ordinary people, many of them old friends. The church retained many blue-collar members, enabling Rockefeller to chat amiably with a blacksmith or mechanic. Such everyday experiences increasingly eluded him as he withdrew behind the high gates of his estates. On Sunday, June 14, 1903, John Siddall got a windfall beyond his most feverish hopes, when Rockefeller not only appeared but delivered a short Children's Day talk at the Sunday school. "If I had been able to foretell what happened yesterday, I should have advised you to come from Titusville to spend Sunday in Cleveland," Siddall told Tarbell. He described Rockefeller in ministerial coat and silk hat, sitting before the pulpit and surveying the crowd apprehensively as if fearful for his safety. "He bows his head and mutters his prayer and sings the hymns and nods his head and claps his hands in a sort of a mechanical way. It's all work to him, a part of his business. He thinks that after he has done this for an hour or two, he has warded off the devil for another week." Only months later did Siddall learn of the anonymous charity Rockefeller practiced each Sunday morning, handing out money in small envelopes to needy congregants. "Doesn't this shake your belief in the theory of pure hypocrisy?" Siddall then asked Tarbell, noting the curiously compartmentalized nature of Rockefeller's mind. "In one part is legitimate business, in another corrupt business, in another political depravity, in another, somewhere in his being, religious experience and life." This was a richer, more accurate appraisal of Rockefeller than that contained in his earlier reductive jibe. In the early fall, Siddall found out that Rockefeller, before returning to New York, would deliver a short farewell address at the Sunday school, and he begged Ida Tarbell to attend. "I will see that we have seats where we will have a full view of the man," he promised her. "You will get him in action." They planned to squeeze between them an illustrator, George Varian, who would execute rapid sketches of Rockefeller. Tarbell felt a little mean about secretly ambushing Rockefeller in church, and she dreaded that they would be caught. To prevent this, she asked Siddall to pack the pew with three or four tall Confederates who would shield Varian and his notebook. When Tarbell and Siddall arrived at the Sunday school room that morning, she wrinkled her nose at the shabby surroundings. A dismal room with barbaric dark green paper with big gold designs, cheap stained glass windows, awkward gas fixtures. Suddenly, Siddall gave her a violent dig in the ribs. "There he is," he breathed. The hairless figure in the doorway did not disappoint Tarbell. As she wrote, "There was an awful age in his face, the oldest man I had ever seen, I thought, but what power." He slowly doffed his coat and hat, slid a black skull cap over his bald head, and sat flush against the wall, giving him an unobstructed view of the room, which Tarbell thought a security precaution. During his brief talk to the children, she was impressed by the clear strength of his voice. After the Sunday school speech, the McClure's contingent packed a church pew in the auditorium for the service. Self-conscious about being there, Tarbell was convinced that Rockefeller would pick her out of the crowd, but he apparently did not. In her 1905 character study, Tarbell stressed Rockefeller's fidgety behavior, the way he craned his neck and scanned the room, as if searching for assassins. "My 2 hours' study of Mr. Rockefeller aroused a feeling I had not expected, which time has intensified. I was sorry for him. I know no companion so terrible as fear. Mr. Rockefeller, for all the conscious power written in his face and voice and figure, was afraid, I told myself, afraid of his own kind." It did not occur to her that she had contributed to that fear. This edgy behavior was vitally important for Tarbell, because it suggested that Rockefeller had a guilt-ridden conscience, that God was torturing him, that he could not enjoy his ill-gotten wealth. The ordinary reader could find no more satisfying fantasy. For what good this undoubted power of achievement? For what good this towering wealth, if one must be forever peering to see what is behind? It certainly never occurred to Tarbell that Rockefeller might be searching the congregation for charity recipients. Despite her fears, Tarbell and her associates evaded detection at the Euclid Avenue Baptist Church that Sunday morning. It was the only time that Tarbell ever actually stood in Rockefeller's presence. Ironically, he never knowingly set eyes on the woman who did more than any other person to transmogrify his image. By the end of her 19-part series, Tarbell had come to regard Rockefeller as the embodiment of evil. She had largely maintained a clinical tone, despite many shrill digressions, but in the poisonous two-part character study of July and August 1905, she allowed her vengeful feelings to blossom. Throwing off any pose of objectivity, she found in Rockefeller concentration, craftiness, cruelty, and something indefinably repulsive. She described him as a living mummy, hideous and diseased, leprous and reptilian, his physiognomy blighted by moral degeneracy. The pious church-going image that Rockefeller projected was only a hypocritical facade brilliantly created by the predatory businessman. The disease which in the last 3 or 4 years has swept Mr. Rockefeller's head bare of hair, stripped away even eyelashes and eyebrows, has revealed all the strength of his great head. The big cheeks are puffy, bulging unpleasantly under the eyes, and the skin which covers them has a curiously unhealthy pallor. It is this puffiness, this unclean flesh which repels, as the thin slit of a mouth terrifies. Mr. Rockefeller may have made himself the richest man in the world, but he has paid. Nothing but paying ever plows such lines in a man's face, ever sets his lips to such a melancholy angle. Rockefeller could brush off Tarbell's critique of his business methods as biased, but he was deeply pained by the character study. He was furious that Tarbell converted his alopecia, which had produced so much suffering, into a sign of moral turpitude. He was no less upset by her charge that he was ill at ease in his church, for this struck at the heart of his lifelong faith. As he said later, he was not fearful in church, because there was no place where I felt more at home in a public assembly than in this old church, where I had been since a boy of 14 years of age, and my friends were all about me. The patent cruelty of the character study steeled Rockefeller against Tarbell's valid strictures about his business methods. For Rockefeller, this malice was the final proof he needed of Ida Tarbell's bias against him. As legions of Rockefeller enemies sought interviews with Tarbell, she was bound to encounter the most vituperative foe, his brother Frank. Refusing to forgive John after the Corrigan affair, Frank still popped up in the press from time to time to deliver flaming imprecations against John. During the McClure's series, he was quoted by a Washington paper as saying that the fear of kidnapping had become a mania with his brother, and that armed men accompanied him everywhere, ready to repel any effort to capture him. In fact, Frank had not set eyes on his brother in years and could only parrot gossip. Tarbell was always coy about how she met Frank Rockefeller, but her papers tell a startling tale. Although Siddall's brother had been one of Frank's attorneys, this had not helped him to line up an interview. Then a breakthrough occurred in January 1904, when Siddall learned that the Tarbell series had won 2 unexpected admirers, Frank's daughter and son-in-law, Helen and Walter Bowler. Using Mr. Bowler as a go-between, Frank stipulated his conditions for a tête-à-tête with Tarbell. "I want no member of my family to know of this interview. Nobody is ever to know of it. I shall see Miss Tarbell in my Garfield Building office. No one is to be present. No clerk is to know who Miss T is." Following instructions, Tarbell even donned a disguise. It would be one of the most disturbing interviews of her long career. Though Frank seemed candid, he chewed tobacco and talked incontinently, spewing forth bile against his brother. At moments, his self-pitying harangues suggested a deranged man. Afterward, Tarbell jotted down impressions, including his off-the-record statements, for her files. "He seemed dimly conscious that it was unnatural and monstrous to talk to me, and yet to be so bitter that he could not restrain himself. He began to talk of his brother by referring to him as that individual. 'I have nothing to do with that individual,' he said. 'I never want to see him. I have not seen him but once for 8 years, and that was by accident. He has ruined my life, nearly drove my wife insane. 2 years ago, I had to put her in a sanitarium, where she stayed for nearly a year. and this entirely came of this man's vindictive feeling of me. He says, I have read every one of your articles. Some of them I have read two or three times. I have never known of any literary subject which interested me so much or interested the people with whom I came in contact so much. Unaware of the stormy history between the two brothers, Tarbell confessed that Frank was the last person she had expected to volunteer as a source. A brisk, businesslike journalist, she was appalled by the ugly emotions he betrayed, however much she welcomed his information. Predictably, Frank dragged out his self-serving version of the Corrigan case. He portrayed John as a sadist, who took pleasure in lending people money, then seizing their collateral and destroying them when they did not repay. Cleveland could be paved with the mortgages that he has foreclosed on people who were in a tight place. Though Tarbell came to believe that John Dee had acted in an ethical manner with Corrigan, she quoted so freely from the original lawsuit against Rockefeller as to obscure that she was siding with him. Aside from the Corrigan case, Frank contributed few facts and preferred to vent his spleen. He told Tarbell that John had only two ambitions, to be very rich and very old. And he even chastised Setti, calling her a narrow-minded, stingy, and pious woman, whose greatest goal was to be known as a good Christian and to impress the world with the piety and domestic harmony of the family. According to Frank, Setti was a crafty, avaricious hypocrite who ensured that John's charities were widely publicized and tinged with the proper religious coloring. Touching up this gruesome portrait, Frank later told one of Tarbell's assistants, John has the delusion that God has appointed him to administer all the wealth in the world, and in his efforts to do this, he has destroyed men right and left. I tell you that when you publish this story, the people will arise and stone him out of the community. He is a monster. Frank had two other shockers for Tarbell. First, he told her that the real reason that I have sent for you is that I want someday to write the life of my brother. I cannot write. You can do the kind of thing I want, and I want to know if you will do it using my material. Tarbell did not quite picture herself as Frank Rockefeller's ghostwriter. On the other hand, she did not wish to alienate him and mumbled something about helping him if her editorial work allowed the time. Then Frank came up with a remarkable finale to his ravings about his brother. I know you think I am bitter and that it is unnatural, but this man has ruined my life. Why I have not killed him, I do not understand. It must be that there is a God who prevented me doing such a thing, for there have been 100 times when, if I had met him on the street, I know that I should have shot him. Tarbell did not quote these background statements and preserved Frank's anonymity. But such lunacy should have told her to exercise extreme care in dealing with the Corrigan case. Instead, in a lapse in judgment, she used Frank's material in such a slipshod, misleading manner that Rockefeller justly accused her of slanting the story. Perhaps the main reason that Frank did not blow out his brother's brains was that he did not want to murder one of his main bankers. Unable to curb his speculative appetite, Frank took another emergency loan of $184,000 from William during the 1907 panic. What Frank did not know, but surely must have suspected, was that John had guaranteed half the loan, secured by 800 head of cattle, and 100 mules on Frank's Kansas ranch. In fact, John Dee carried this debt until Frank died, though a moment came in early 1912 when Frank again sounded off about his brother to reporters, and John dispatched a lawyer to inform his ungrateful brother about the true source of the money that had so long sustained him. For nearly 3 years, from November 1902 to August 1905, Ida Tarbell fired projectiles at Rockefeller and Standard Oil without taking fire in return. As one newspaper wondered aloud, is the pen mightier than the money bag? Is Ida M. Tarbell, weak woman, more potent than John D. Rockefeller millionaire? As the Tarbell series demonstrated, the new media possessed a power that rivaled that of the business institutions they covered. Paradoxically, the more Tarbell invoked the malevolent power of Standard Oil, the more she proved the reverse. At moments, Tarbell herself was startled by the kid glove treatment. She wrote to Sidall in February 1903, It is very interesting to note now that the thing is well underway and I have not been kidnapped or sued for libel, as some of my friends prophesied. People are willing to talk freely to me. From today's perspective, when corporations have teams of publicists who swing into action at the first whiff of trouble, Standard Oil's muted reaction appears to be a perplexing miscalculation. Tarbell got enough wrong that a modern public relations expert could have dented her credibility and shaken Samuel McClure with the threat of a libel suit. Rockefeller could, for instance, have exposed the hoax of the Widow Backus story. In the spring of 1905, he contemplated a lawsuit against Tarbell for alleging that he had perjured himself by denying knowledge of a Southern Improvement Company when his interrogator had garbled the name of the South Improvement Company. After Tarbell published her character study of Rockefeller, he authorized Virgil Klein to contest her treatment of the Corrigan case. Klein pointed out that Tarbell's fallacious account was drawn largely from the original petition filed against Rockefeller, not the exculpatory testimony that followed in the case. "Mr. Klein says I used charges made in the petition instead of in the testimony," Tarbell wrote, unfazed, in an internal memo at the time. "I did, and I see no reason why I should not have done so." Tough challenges from Rockefeller might have blunted Tarbell's confidence and made readers question her sources. The McClure's series showed that the public-be-damned attitude that had served industrial barons well in the 19th century now made them easy prey for investigative journalists who fed a public famished for revelations of misconduct. The schizoid American worship of millionaires was shot through with envy and a desire to see these demigods punished and desecrated. So why did Rockefeller stick to his self-defeating silence? One side of him simply did not want to be bothered by libel suits. "Life is short," he wrote to Parmalee Prentice, "and we have not time to heed the reports of foolish and unprincipled men." He was also afraid that if he sued for libel, it would dignify the charges against him and only prolong the controversy. Strolling about Forest Hill one day, a friend suggested that he respond to the Tarbell slanders. At that moment, he spotted a worm crawling across their path. "If I step on that worm, I will call attention to it," he said. "If I ignore it, it will disappear." In certain instances, he was muzzled from responding because of his involvement in ongoing court cases. But the main reason for Rockefeller's silence was that he couldn't dispute just a few of Tarbell's assertions without admitting the truth of many others. And a hard core of truth did lie behind the scattered errors. When Gates urged him to rebut Tarbell on the Backus affair and the SIC perjury charge, Rockefeller agreed he could do so, but that going further than the Backus and the South Improvement Company cases may involve the necessity of going thoroughly into the whole book, and he did not wish to do that. 2 months later, Tarbell herself reached a similar conclusion in McClure's. "His self-control has been masterful. He knows, nobody better, that to answer is to invite discussion. To answer is to call attention to the facts in the case." Rockefeller claimed that he had not even deigned to glance at McClure's, a claim inadvertently refuted by Adela Prentice Hughes, SETI's nurse and companion, who traveled with the Rockefellers on a Western train trip in the spring of 1903. "He liked to have things read to him, and during these months I read aloud Ida Tarbell's diatribes," she recalled. "He listened musingly with keen interest and no resentment. He tossed out wisecracks about his lady friend or Miss Tarbarrel, but would not be drawn into serious discussion about her. Not a word," he said, "not a word about that misguided woman." His office, however, kept him well apprised of her allegations as they appeared. Nonetheless, it is true that Rockefeller never formally sat down and read her searing indictment. "I don't think I ever read Ida Tarbell's book. I may have skimmed it," he said a decade later. "I wonder what it amounts to anyway in the minds of people who have no animus." When William O. Inglis began to interview Rockefeller in 1917 and read aloud portions of Tarbell's work, it grew clear that Rockefeller had only a vague familiarity with the series. It was equally clear that beneath his pose of stoic fortitude, he was still angry. His private comments about her were marked by a heavy sniggering and dry mockery that he never exhibited in public. "How clever she is, compared with poor Lloyd, who was always hysterical. She makes her picture clear and attractive, no matter how unjust she is. She really could write." At the same time, he was convinced that this daughter of Oil Creek was animated more with jealousy begotten by the inability of her father and brother and some of her neighbors to do as well as the Standard Oil Company. Far from making him repent and reconsider, the Tarbell series hardened his faith in his career. How dismayed Tarbell would have been to find Rockefeller writing to Archbold in July 1905, "I never appreciated more than at present the importance of our taking care of our business, holding it and increasing it in every part of the world." Faced with Tarbell's invective, Rockefeller was too proud to give the world the satisfaction of knowing he was wounded. The press was rife with speculation about his reaction. "Mr. Rockefeller's friends say that it is all cruel punishment for him, and that he writhes under these attacks," reported one Detroit newspaper. A Philadelphia paper chimed in that "the richest man in the world sits by the hour at Forest Hill, his chin sunk on his breast. He has lost interest in golf. He has become morose. Never free in his conversation with his employees, he now speaks only when absolutely necessary, and then gives his directions tersely and absently." These reports tell more about the popular thirst for revenge than about Rockefeller's actual response. He was never tormented by guilt, and went on playing golf. Yet he was more vulnerable to criticism than he admitted. During this period, he grew closer to his son, who became his confidant just as Seti's maladies made it more difficult for her to discharge that function. Junior remembered, "He used to talk to me about the criticisms to which he was exposed, and I think it eased his mind to do so, because beneath his apparent insensitiveness, he was a sensitive man. But he always ended up by saying, 'Well, John, we have to be patient. We have been successful, and these people haven't.'" Even John D. Rockefeller Sr. required cathartic chats in time of trouble. Having been filled to the brim with morality and religion, Rockefeller's children must have been disoriented to see him exposed as a corporate criminal. How did they reconcile the rapacious Rockefeller splashed across McClure's pages with the reverend father that they knew? As a rule, they fell back upon an implicit faith in father's integrity, which was more a matter of religious faith than anything grounded in fact. Senior might talk in general terms about Tarbell's criticisms, but refrained from specific rebuttals, an omission that especially tormented his son, who had taken his parents' morality at face value. Junior had always been prey to tension-related symptoms, and they intensified with each new installment of McClure's. By late 1904, gripped by migraine headaches and insomnia, he wavered on the edge of a breakdown. Under doctor's orders, he, Abby, and their baby daughter Babs sailed to Cannes in December 1904 for what would extend into a year-long absence from 26 Broadway. They toured the charming Languedoc country towns, drove through the Maritime Alps, and ambled along the Promenade des Anglais. But Junior's troubles were so intransigent that their projected one-month stay lengthened to 6. Junior's breakdown has been variously attributed to overwork, exhaustion, or an identity crisis, but he himself privately emphasized the toll of the Tarbell series, as well as two subsequent controversies: the tainted money affair, and his leadership of a Bible class. While Tarbell's articles were running, Rockefeller, his wife, his son, and two of his three daughters were afflicted by serious medical problems or nervous strain. In 1903, Rockefeller had such severe bronchial troubles that he took a rest cure near San Diego. That spring, Bessie suffered the stroke or heart ailment that left her sadly demented, and the following April, Charles Strong took his wife off to Cannes, where she and Junior may have consulted the same nervous strain specialists. In April 1904, Seti had the attack that left her semi-paralyzed, and from which she took 2 years to recover. Finally, Plunged into depression after the birth of her daughter Matilda in April 1905, Edith fled to Europe. Understandably, the Rockefellers did not wish to broadcast their misfortunes to the world. The price that the series exacted on them, like so much else, was scrupulously hidden from both the public and posterity. The most stinging personal blow to Rockefeller was not Tarbell's exposé of his chicanery, but her defamatory portrait of his father, published in the two-part character study. Rockefeller had never dropped the pretense that his father, like his mother, was a person of sterling virtue. Even in later years, he told one of his grandsons, "I had a rich inheritance in foundation building from both my father and mother, and I reverence them, and often long to see them even though it is so many years since they passed away." Now readers across the country were introduced to the protean Doc Rockefeller, snake oil salesman, ne'er-do-well, bigamist, and absentee father. Most mortifying of all to Rockefeller, Tarbell disinterred his oldest and deepest shame, Big Bill's rape indictment in Moravia in the late 1840s. By this point, Rockefeller seldom had dealings with his infirm elderly father, who was increasingly crotchety, and routed urgent queries to him via brother Frank, to whom he was not speaking either. Tarbell had stumbled upon Doc Rockefeller's existence in serendipitous fashion. One day in April 1903, J.M. Siddall was on the phone with Rockefeller's brother-in-law, the genial William Rudd, when Rudd let slip that William Avery Rockefeller was still alive. Perhaps Rudd did not at first perceive the magnitude of this admission. "Oh, yes, the old gentleman is living. He travels about from place to place in the West. The last I knew of him was in Dakota. We don't know where he is now." Sitting there agape, Siddall could scarcely believe his ears. Scoops did not come any bigger than this. The second he got off the phone, he pounded out a typewritten report to Tarbell. "I have always supposed that Mr. Rockefeller's father died years and years ago, and I am startled almost beyond expression to learn, as I have through the telephone within the last 5 minutes, that the old man is living. I never in my life was more surprised. I am under the impression that I have been told over and over that the old man died some years ago, and I am sure from W.C. Rudd's attitude toward me today that there is something secret and mysterious about the thing." In his hands, Siddall now had a thread that would lead him and then other reporters into a vast investigative maze. Through his brother, Siddall sounded out Frank Rockefeller's secretary, who offered a helpful hint. Doc Rockefeller lived in either North or South Dakota. "He doesn't know where and says frankly, though confidentially, that he doesn't dare ask Frank or any members of the family," Siddall informed Tarbell. This only added to the mystery. Why had Rockefeller so thoroughly expunged his father from his life? Siddall next prodded a reporter from the Cleveland Plain Dealer to ask Dr. Bigger, very casually, whether on a recent trip west with Rockefeller they had detoured to visit Doc Rockefeller. At first, Bigger walked straight into the trap. "No, we didn't go through Dakota," he began to blurt out, then, seeing his error, clammed up. Siddall and Tarbell scored their biggest coup with Rockefeller's old friend Hiram Brown, whom Tarbell had met while researching her Lincoln book. During a meandering chat at Forest Hill, Brown sounded out Rockefeller about his father, which produced the following exchange, as recorded in Tarbell's research files. "Well, sir, the old gentleman is on his last legs, I guess. He is absolutely senile. He is living on a farm near Cedar Valley, Cedar County, Iowa. He has lost all his powers. He is 93 years old, you know. They say the old gentleman is so deaf that he cannot hear a word. His nieces are taking good care of him. He is living on the farm because he owns it, because it is the place that is most pleasing to him." "Well, John, what a comical, funny old fellow he is," Brown said. "Yes," John replied. "They say the old gentleman lies on the bed and swears all day. I haven't seen him since he was here 3 years ago." This last sentence alluded to the party that John had thrown at Forest Hill for Bill and his erstwhile cronies. When Ida Tarbell interviewed Frank Rockefeller in 1904, he gave his own self-serving account of John and Bill's final break. At age 90, Bill had decided to bequeath his $87,000 in property equally among his four living children, According to Frank, John had wanted his one-quarter share plus repayment of an outstanding $35,000 loan. Bill, irate, believed that the gift should cancel out the loan. As Tarbell paraphrased Frank's narration in a memo, "The old man was so furious that now he will not come home. He says he will not live in the same state with his son." As Tarbell peeled away bits and pieces of Bill's clandestine life, she did not know how abominably Bill and Frank had behaved over the years, how much they had borrowed from John, nor how erroneous their tirades against him were. Tarbell was never able to track down Doc Rockefeller or figure out the riddle of his double life, but her revelation that he was still alive somewhere created a national sensation. Among the intrigued was Joseph Pulitzer, publisher of The World, who would inveigh against Standard Oil as the most pitiless trust. Pulitzer served his readers an incongruous mix of scabrous stories and lofty crusades against corporate abuse. "Money is the great power of today," he declared. "Men sell their souls for it. Women sell their bodies for it." He wished to purge capitalism of its vulgar excesses so that a more enlightened capitalism might flourish, and he evinced a special animus toward Rockefeller, whom he christened the Father of Trusts, the King of Monopolists, the Czar of the oil business, a man who relentlessly crushes all competitors. Hence the story of Doc Rockefeller, uniting as it did the spice of family scandal with Standard Oil's notoriety, was a godsend. Stirring the pot, Pulitzer offered $8,000 to anyone who could provide information about Rockefeller's father, a reward that set off a nationwide manhunt. It is a credit to Bill's matchless duplicity that teams of reporters were immediately stymied in this search. There was also a fair bit of luck involved. When McClure's printed a picture of Rockefeller's father to accompany the character sketch, many Freeport, Illinois residents were shocked to see Dr. William Levingston staring out at them. Many traits that Tarbell attributed to Doc Rockefeller sounded oddly reminiscent of their queer local resident. The editor of the Freeport Daily Bulletin contacted McClure's to inform them that they might have mistakenly printed a picture of Dr. William Levingston. Indignant at this insinuation, and totally oblivious of the revelation implicit in the Freeport editor's query, McClure's wrote back and assured the editor that the photo of Rockefeller's father was indeed authentic. Amazingly enough, the National Press Corps never picked up on all the rumors buzzing around Freeport, Illinois. An impatient Pulitzer dispatched one of his star reporters, J.W. Slatt, to Cleveland, hoping for a quick solution. But 2 weeks later, Slatt slogged back to New York, weary and dispirited. In a despairing memo to Pulitzer, he stressed the inordinate effort required to track down Rockefeller's father and hinted that it would be thankless drudgery. He hoped that the matter would end there. "In just about time enough for the report to have reached Mr. Pulitzer, I was ordered to take up the search and stay on it until I found Mr. Rockefeller, regardless of time or expense," Slatt revealed to William O. Inglis a decade later. It seems that the story fascinated Mr. Pulitzer, the disappearance of the father of the richest man in the world, a thrilling mystery that would interest people everywhere. So thoroughly had Doc Rockefeller erased his tracks that Slatt had only one tenuous clue. During the reunion a few years earlier at Forest Hill, Big Bill had slyly told his buddies that he resided somewhere out west and shot shirt-tail swans in a nearby lake. Slatt consulted a naturalist who said that a wild goose nicknamed the shirt-tail swan abounded in parts of Alaska. Setting forth with this sketchy information and a photo of Doc Rockefeller, the miserable Slatt trekked through Alaska, tramping from lake to lake. Once he had exhausted this terrain, he heard that Bill had been sighted in Indiana and was off on another wild goose chase. For a time, he peddled razors door to door, trying to pry information loose from suspicious German farmers. "I'll bet I shaved myself 10 or 15 times a day till my face was sore selling the blamed razors." Even clean-shaven, Slatt came up empty-handed. Desperate, he turned to Frank Rockefeller, the only person in direct communication with the Phantom. Bribing Frank's secretary with candy and theater tickets, Slatt gained access to Frank, who was no less protective of his father than John was. He was quite upset by Slat's quest, and offered a straightforward deal. If Slat called off the search, Frank would repay him with sensational findings about his brother. To enhance the deal's allure, Frank exhumed from his drawer an impressive manuscript, thick as a telephone directory. After a flurry of calls to New York, the World editors agreed to terminate their search for Doc Rockefeller for 60 days if they could, in return, publish Frank's philippic against John. Having never dealt with Frank, Slat naively trusted him. But when the time expired, Frank would not return his calls, and Slat had no choice but to accost him on a Cleveland street and bluntly remind him that the World had fulfilled its end of the bargain. In exchange, he demanded the manuscript. "No, sir," Frank snapped. "Not one word of it." Aghast, Slat said the World would publish the inflammatory remarks Frank had made about John in his office. "If you publish that," retorted Frank, "I'll kill you." However much he detested John, Frank must have feared that any published comments would dry up the loans from his brothers. In August 1907, still baffled in its search for Doc Rockefeller, the World ran the interview